This is Bradcast producer Desi Doyen. We're off this week. Today's Bradcast was originally recorded on April 1st, 2025.
These are not normal times in America. And they should not be treated as such.
Thank you, Senator. I'm with you.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, and also in dozens and dozens of fine terrestrial and internet streaming affiliates coast to coast and around the globe, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. We got a lot to get to, as you might have guessed. I will start here because I got to hand it to the Republicans. In recent years, particularly with the rise of Donald Trump, they vowed that if they were ever allowed to return to full power, that they, in their own words, planned to overturn the 20th century. That includes, of course, all of the progress that was made toward union rights, civil rights, the post-war standing and leadership of the United States across the world, and, well, all of the huge governmental and technological advances that the nation and its people have benefited from over that time. And if you had any question previously as to whether these folks meant it or not, I'm really hoping that the last 70 days or so since Trump took office for a second time has helped to convince you that these folks really meant it. They really are working to overturn and reverse about 100 years of progress in this nation and, frankly, across this planet, if they can help it. Just one of their latest announcements towards that end, if one that doesn't seem to be getting the attention it warrants amid all of the other outrages and threats to the standing and constitutional order of this nation. They plan to shut down, not downsize, not restructure, but shut down the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA. And they plan to do so in the middle of the hurricane season. Take that, 20th century. Because, you know, who needs federal emergency management anymore, really? What a liberal slush fund FEMA disaster assistance has been, am I right? More on that in Desi Doyen's latest Green News Report later this hour. Hi, Des.
Hi. It is really, really just astounding, gobsmacking. I am out of adjectives to describe just how insane an idea getting rid of FEMA or dismantling it or breaking it up or moving it to another agency doesn't matter. It's all bad.
It's all bad. Hat tip to David Kurtz at TPM for noting this section of British journalist Ian Dunst's column today, generally focused on yesterday's blockbuster charges and disqualification from public office for 5 years against France's far-right party leader Marie Le Pen for massive embezzlement of public funds, writes Dunt as part of this essay, quote, "We should all take a good hard look at what's happening in the U.S. Not the noise or the clamor, but the bleak constitutional reality of it. This is what happens when you give up on the rule of law. A president who talks openly about going for a third term, who signs executive orders which contradict his country's constitution, who got a rigged Supreme Court to grant him immunity, who ignores court orders, who has his underlings hand out massive million-dollar checks to people to induce them to vote, even though it is explicitly against state law. To watch the United States is to watch the law dissolve into authoritarian government." That is, of course, what we are watching yet again today. Welcome to the Bradcast. In today's edition, even as voters head to the polls in Florida, Wisconsin, and elsewhere right now in hopes of pushing back at that rise of authoritarian power by the Republican Party, we will have noteworthy results and any problems for voters as reported on tomorrow's Bradcast. And as our guest joining us momentarily, who regular listeners will know well by now, stands by to detail a major court ruling overnight that you probably have yet to hear about, but will want to hear about, and have, in fact, heard about for years on this show. In today's version of the Bradcast, the massive assault on the federal government by the President of the United States himself and his unelected henchmen continues apace. As AP leads today, employees across the massive U.S. Health and Human Services Department, or HHS, received notices of dismissal Tuesday in an overhaul ultimately expected to lay off up to 10,000 people. The cuts include researchers, scientists, doctors, support staff, and senior leaders, leaving the federal government without many of the key experts who have long guided U.S. decisions on medical research, drug approvals, and other issues. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. announced the plan last week to remake the department, which through its many agencies is responsible for tracking health trends and disease outbreaks, conducting and funding medical research, and monitoring the safety of food and medicine, as well as for administering health insurance programs for nearly half the country. Some staffers began getting termination notices in their work inboxes at 5 a.m. today, on the same day that they were being fired, while others found out their job had been eliminated after standing in long lines outside offices in Washington, Maryland, and Atlanta, to find out that their badges no longer worked. Some gathered at local coffee shops and lunch spots after being turned away, finding out that they had been eliminated after decades of service. One wondered aloud if it was a cruel April Fool's Day joke. It was cruel, but it was no joke. A coalition of state attorneys general have sued the Trump administration as of Tuesday, arguing that the cuts are illegal, would reverse progress, for example, on the opioid crisis, and would throw mental health systems into chaos. Last week, HHS provided a breakdown of just some of the cuts. 2,400 jobs at the CDC, which monitors for infectious disease outbreaks and works with public agencies nationwide. 1,200 jobs at the National Institutes of Health. Interestingly, only 300 jobs at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which oversees the Affordable Care Act marketplace, Medicare and Medicaid, and 3,500 jobs at the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, which inspects and sets safety standards for medications, medical devices, and foods. As ABC News reports, Robert Califf, who served two stints as commissioner of the FDA, said in a LinkedIn post on Tuesday, the agency, quote, as we've known it, is finished. Quote, the FDA, as we've known it, is finished, with most of the leaders with institutional knowledge and deep understanding of product development and safety no longer employed, said Califf. I believe that history will see this as a huge mistake, he said. I will be glad if I'm proven wrong, but even then, there is no good reason to treat people this way. It will be interesting to hear from the new leadership how they plan to put Humpty Dumpty back together again, he added. Reversing, overturning the 20th century. Not everyone is taking this lying down. Some, of course, including us, are doing whatever we can think of to push back at the madness, to let people know. New Jersey's U.S. Senator Cory Booker did the same, beginning at around 7 p.m. Eastern time on Monday and overnight into today on the floor of the U.S. Senate, where as we go to air, I believe he is now entering his 23rd hour of nonstop speaking. Not as an official filibuster, but to bring attention to all of this madness. To do whatever he can, quote, as long as I am physically able, he said, as a way to, quote, recognize the urgency of this moment. Booker said on social media that he aimed, quote, to lift the voices of Americans who are being harmed and not being heard in this moment of crisis. His speech, his remarks, which by the time we finish here today, I believe, will be just about 18 minutes shy of the longest ever such holding of the floor in U.S. history. His remarks criticized the Trump administration for, among many other things over the past 24 hours of, quote, putting profits over people, trying to gut Medicaid and Medicare, threatening changes to Social Security, dismantling the Education Department, accidentally deporting a Maryland resident, and more. Here's how Cory Booker started on Monday night.
Tonight, I rise with the intention of getting in some good trouble. I rise with the intention of disrupting the normal business of the United States Senate for as long as I am physically able. I rise tonight because I believe sincerely that our country is in crisis. Republicans as well as Democrats are talking to me about what they feel is a sense of dread about a growing crisis, or what they point to about what is going wrong, that bedrock commitments in our country that both sides rely on, that people from all backgrounds rely on, those bedrock commitments are being broken. Unnecessary hardships are being borne by Americans of all backgrounds. And institutions which are special in America, which are precious, which are unique in our country, are being recklessly, and I would say even unconstitutionally, affected, attacked, and even shattered. In just 71 days, the President of the United States has inflicted so much harm on Americans' safety, financial stability, the core foundations of our democracy, and even our aspirations as a people for, from our highest offices, a sense of common decency. These are not normal times in America. And they should not be treated as such. The threats to American people and American democracy are grave and urgent, and we all must do more. We all must do more against them. But those 10 words, if it is to be, it is up to me. All of us have to think of those 10 words, 10 two-letter words. If it is to be, if it is up to me, because I believe generations from now will look back at this moment and have a single question. Where were you? Where were you when our country was in crisis and when American people were asking for help? Help me. Help me. Did we speak up?
It was Cory Booker at the beginning of his now nearly 24-hour remarks so far on the floor of the U.S. Senate. Here's how he sounded about 15 hours in.
He promised to lower your grocery prices, they're higher. He promised, I'll be a better steward of the economy. It's worse than we inherited. Over and over, he's breaking promises and doing outrageous things like disappearing people off of American streets, violating fundamental principles of this document, invoking the Alien Enemies Act from the 1700s that was last used to put Japanese Americans in internment camps? Do we see what's happening? How much is enough?
Desi, he sounds pretty good. I've been plowing through a legal ruling today that we'll discuss momentarily with our guest, but you have been dipping in from time to time as Booker has continued his marathon remarks. How's it been going?
It is going actually very well. The last time I checked in a few minutes ago, Cory Booker was still going strong. He doesn't even sound tired at all.
Really?
Which is kind of amazing. he hasn't been doing this entirely by himself. He mentioned that his mother is there, his brother is there, his cousin. He has family members there to support him. He also has, lots of Democratic senators who have been there with him. Chris Murphy, senator from Connecticut. Mm-hmm. He has been there the entire time. I'm not sure if he's taken a break since then, but he was there from the beginning. And one of the things that Chris Murphy has been doing is going on cable news programs. He was on CNN, for example, earlier today, where he pointed out that the reason why Cory Booker is doing this is that he's trying to focus on how all of Trump's destructiveness and his destruction is in service to getting tax cuts for the rich. And Murphy noted that actually what Booker is doing, you know, he's actually halting the Senate from doing any further operations. For example, Murphy said that there is a procedural vote that is supposed to come up this week on cutting $880 million from Medicaid. And Republicans are dead set on it, and Booker is basically stopping them from doing that.
So even though this is not an official filibuster to stop specific legislation or a specific vote, it is delaying legislation, is delaying votes in the U.S. Senate, ultimately.
Yeah, and I also want to point out, it's really inspirational. If you have a chance to watch this, it's posted on his YouTube page.
If you've got 24 free hours.
Check in at any point. Senators have been jumping in to help him. They'll ask him questions, and he'll say, I will answer the question, but I will not leave the floor, which he's required to say, mm-hmm. to keep this going. And they have been helping him out, giving him a chance to rest for a bit, asking him questions. He's been telling stories. They've been telling stories of Americans who are directly harmed by these cuts that Trump and Elon Musk and the Doge bros have been doing as they destroy essential services and the capacity of the U.S. government to serve the American people. It's extraordinary and it's historic, and I hope it sticks and helps.
As they try to overturn the 20th century.
Yeah.
People doing whatever they can. We're doing whatever we can. Cory Booker is doing whatever we can. I hope you are doing whatever you can. It does matter. Ultimately, of course, reversing course is going to come down to voters at the polling place, as always, even in these impossible to imagine times. As noted, we'll have election results from two closely watched U.S. House special elections in Florida and the election that will determine ideological control of the Wisconsin Supreme Court and all that comes with it for Wisconsin and the nation on tomorrow's broadcast, as those elections are underway as we go to air today. But for now, well, we've got the results of a long-awaited federal judge's verdict in a long-running case seeking to ban Georgia's 100% unverifiable touchscreen voting systems, to replace them with verifiable hand-marked paper ballot systems in the critical swing state. And, well, Marilyn Marks, one of the plaintiffs and the leader of that long-running challenge as head of the Coalition for Good Governance, she joins us next to discuss that judge's verdict. That's straight ahead on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast. We'll be back soon.
That's the night that the lights went out in Georgia.
Well, gosh, I hope it wasn't election night when those lights went out, because no one would be able to vote across the great state of Georgia, given their 100% unverifiable electronic voting systems used at all the polling places. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Okay, over the past nearly 8 years now, the nonprofit, nonpartisan good government group known as the Coalition for Good Governance and its founder, executive director, and election integrity and security champion, Marilyn Marks, have spearheaded a federal lawsuit in the great state of Georgia seeking to restore verifiable, hand-marked paper ballots to the critical swing state's elections for all voters. Way back in 2002, following the 2000 presidential election fiasco, the states of Georgia and Maryland were the first in the union to move to a statewide touchscreen voting system for all voters at the polling place. Both states used paperless, unverifiable touchscreen voting systems, technically known as direct recording electronic or DRE systems, made by a company named Diebold, which later changed the name of its voting system division to Premier Voting Systems after the terrible, vulnerable, often failed voting systems had tarnished the reputation of the previously venerable 150-year-old company that originally made its name and reputation after Diebold's steel safes were reportedly among the few things left standing following the Great Chicago Fire of 1871. In the years that followed Georgia's 2002 move to 100% unverifiable computerized touchscreen voting, as more and more enormous security vulnerabilities were revealed in those systems, often reported in detail and sometimes uncovered at bradblog.com, the Coalition for Good Governance, also known as CGG or just the Coalition, filed a federal lawsuit with other plaintiffs that was eventually titled Curling v. Raffensperger. It was filed in Atlanta in Georgia's Northern U.S. District Court. Since then, during the process of discovery, the coalition has uncovered massive vulnerabilities in Georgia's voting system, including the fact, for example, that for many years, potentially, the state's voting system database files were left sitting unprotected for anyone to download on an unprotected computer server. The thanks that they received for helping to reveal that discovery was a threat of prosecution by the state's then Republican Secretary of State, now Governor Brian Kemp. In 2019, the coalition had a huge court victory in the Curling case when they won a ruling from Judge Amy Totenberg finding that indeed those Diebold touchscreen voting systems were vulnerable to massive error and/or manipulation, and were so insecure that their use in Georgia's elections violated rights guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution itself. Judge Totenberg ordered that those Diebold systems could no longer be used in Georgia elections. CGG and its stable of world-class voting system and cybersecurity experts rallied Kemp's successor and still current Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger to replace the Diebold touchscreen systems with a verifiable hand-marked paper ballot system for all voters, other than those disabled voters who might prefer to vote with the help of an electronic assistive device. Nonetheless, Raffensperger replaced the Diebold touchscreens with all new touchscreen systems made by a company named Dominion. These systems were known as ballot marking devices, or BMDs. They operated similarly to the Diebold touchscreens, but included a function to print out a representation of the voter's vote on a piece of paper, which could then be reviewed by the voter, accurately or otherwise, before it was cast into a separate optical scanning device to be tabulated. As the Curling case progressed, those systems, the new Dominion BMDs, were revealed by the coalition's experts as having many of the same flaws and security vulnerabilities as the old Diebold systems. And yet, Raffensperger refused to replace them with a hand-marked paper ballot system, as the coalition and many election experts had long urged, despite outcry from even many of Raffensperger's fellow Republican lawmakers by then. During the course of the long Curling case, Marilyn Marks and the coalition also helped discover that supporters of Donald Trump, following his re-election loss in 2020, had surreptitiously breached the statewide Dominion voting system software at an elections office in rural Coffee County, Georgia, a story that we helped break on this program, and then shared the proprietary code from those systems across the internet. That breach eventually resulted in criminal charges and several guilty pleas against a number of the conspirators, including Donald Trump himself, who pleaded innocent in a major RICO case that was brought by state prosecutor Fani Willis in Atlanta. All of that thanks again to Marilyn Marks and her team at the Coalition for Good Governance. Years later, at the beginning of 2024, a 17-day trial was finally held in Curling v. Raffensperger before Judge Totenberger in Atlanta's Federal District Court. In addition to plaintiffs' experts demonstrating during the trial that the Dominion touchscreen voting systems could be hacked
by virtually any voter with little more than a ballpoint pen at the polling place. The coalition also made the case that the QR codes that are printed out on each paper ballot by the computer, which are then used by the tabulator to record the voter's vote, might not actually match the human-readable text representation of the voter's vote that was printed on the paper ballot by the touchscreen system and presumably verified by the voter. And though the trial was completed in January of 2024, the plaintiffs have waited now more than a year, yes, even throughout another presidential election in 2024, for a ruling from Judge Totenberg following that long-awaited trial. During that time, Republican state lawmakers have adopted a new law to replace or redesign the Dominion voting systems, which had cost the state well over $100 million originally back in 2020. The lawmakers call for replacing that system with paper ballot systems that do not include an unreadable QR code supposedly containing the voter's vote. Well, a ruling and an order was finally issued in Curling v. Raffensperger late yesterday. And frankly, while not completely unexpected to those of us following the case closely, including Judge Totenberg's careful oversight of the case over the years, it still came, I got to say, as a bit of a surprise, certainly as a disappointment for those of us who care about election integrity and public oversight of our elections. In the conclusion of her 33-page order issued last night after lauding the Curling plaintiffs for their advocacy in this case and, quote, dedication to ensuring that Georgia's elections are conducted in a transparent, safe, and reliable manner, unquote, Judge Totenberg declared, quote, ultimately, plaintiffs failed to establish at trial that Georgia's continued use of the BMD system will likely cause them to suffer a legally cognizable injury. The court, therefore, lacks jurisdiction to consider the merits of plaintiffs' claims. As plaintiffs do not have standing, the legal right to bring the case in the first place, according to the judge, quote, the court lacks jurisdiction to consider the merits of plaintiffs' claims. This case is therefore dismissed, and the clerk is directed to close this case. In a statement on behalf of the Coalition for Good Governance today, Executive Director Marilyn Marks noted, quote, we are deeply disappointed by the court's ruling that the plaintiffs lack standing to pursue our case. We believe this is a serious misinterpretation of the law. She notes the court did not reach the merits of the case, including the extensive evidence presented by many of the nation's leading experts showing that Georgia's touchscreen voting system is insecure and unsuitable for use in public elections. This decision effectively treats the right to vote as merely the right to cast a ballot, not the right to know what vote is being cast and counted, said Marks. That cannot be the law, she said. A system where a voter has no way to know whether their ballot reflects their true selections is fundamentally incompatible with the constitutional right to vote. Joining us now is the great Marilyn Marks, a longtime friend of this program, in addition to being a longtime champion for honest, fair, secure, and publicly overseeable elections in Georgia, and frankly, every state in the union. Marilyn Marks, welcome back to the broadcast on what I know is a disappointing day for you and your colleagues, and frankly, all voters who give a damn about election integrity.
That's right, Brad. Thank you so much for having me on. And yes, the hurt is pretty fresh right now, and we haven't really absorbed this blow yet after 8 years to find out, oh, well, you had no business to be here to begin with here in court.
Yeah, it's really strange. I mean, I guess my first question is, are you able to explain, I know you're not a lawyer, but can you explain how the judge can determine that the state's continuing use of these unverifiable Dominion touchscreens could not be proved as likely to cause plaintiffs to suffer a legally cognizable injury? Can you help us understand that at all?
No, I don't think I can help you understand that. I'm not sure that the lawyers can either, though, Brad, because she's basically said You've got the right to vote. You've got the right to cast a ballot, but you don't have the right to know who you're voting for. And Brett, I think one thing, I mean, you've been explaining to your audience stuff about constitutional harms and the right to vote. Here's a real life example to show that this is not speculative.
Mm-hmm.
And you know this story about DeKalb County, Georgia, mm-hmm. 2022. A candidate by the name of Michelle Long Spears was on the ballot running for county commissioner, and thousands of voters voted for her on the touchscreen.
Mm-hmm.
And it printed out that their vote was for Michelle Long Spears, and they cast their ballot. Lo and behold, she lost big time. People expected her to do better.
Mm-hmm.
As it turns out, while the printed ballot and their touch on the touchscreen had said Michelle Long Spears, the QR code had one of her opponents coded in,
mm-hmm.
so that Michelle Long Spears' votes counted for the opponent. And ultimately, that was all unwound as they did a hand count of the things, but it took major, major, major strife to get the hand count of the ballots and for the county to admit that the ballots were miscoded. But let's think about what the court is saying here. The court is saying, well, yeah, you have the right to cast the ballot, but you don't have the right to know that you're voting for Michelle's opponent. You know, let that be the secret that the machine keeps to itself. You have the right to press the button for Michelle, but not to know that you voted for her opponent. That's pretty shocking. That cannot really be the law, can it, Brad?
Apparently it is, because apparently that does not count as a cognizable injury to voters. I don't understand it. Was that matter, the story of Michelle Long Spears from 2022, was that considered by Judge Totenberg? Was that brought up in the trial and considered?
It was certainly brought up. It was certainly brought up as examples in the filings, and there was discussion of it. Absolutely, just as there was the example that happened in Pennsylvania, in Northampton, Pennsylvania, where when voters would press one thing, something else would come up on the ballot through a different type of barcode. But no, that was certainly discussed. And you know, as you know, I've not even had a chance to catch up with the lawyers yet. I'm talking to you. I'm daring to talk to you on the air before I talk to the lawyers.
I'll try not to get you in trouble. Yeah.
I think I probably already am in trouble. So maybe too late.
Oh, well.
No, one of the things I'm going to ask them is that even Judge Totenberg talked about how in HAVA, a federal statute, you know, it says you have to be able to verify your vote and be able to change your vote if it is wrong. And that is a legally protected interest. It's right there in federal law.
And if
how
you don't...
is it? How is it that this does is not a legally cognizable
yeah,
injury?
I mean, if it's your vote is hidden in this QR code, even if you approve the human readable text, but the vote is actually in the QR code for someone else, that does not seem like a case of a voter being able to verify their vote accurately. Now, the judge, in reading through this ruling today, seems like she agreed with you on pretty much everything. She cites one of your experts, University of Michigan's Dr. Alex Holderman, who's been on this show over the past years. She writes that The systems could be manipulated by altering the QR codes on printed ballots to modify voter selections, and the voters have no practical way to confirm that the QR codes match their intent, even though the QR codes are the only part of the ballot that the scanners count. So, I mean, case by case, she seemed to be agreeing with you, your experts, and your case, which, in addition to leading to a puzzling ruling here of not having the standing, do you have any sense of why it took the judge nearly 8 years and a 17-day trial on the merits before deciding that she couldn't judge the case on the merits?
We don't, because, you know, she has spent so much time on the merits and does seem to agree with us on the merits.
Yeah.
And if you recall, back in her decision in the fall of 2019. Mm-hmm. Fall of 2020, right before the 2020 election. You know, she was saying, yes, it is with these BMD system, it is just a matter of when, not if, this system's going to be hacked.
Yeah.
And she talked about how it cannot be audited. She went through, you know, many, many warnings for the state that essentially this was not a good system. And she never told them they couldn't use it, but she certainly warned them mm-hmm. that they were not doing the right thing by having it. She seemed to agree with us on the merits mm-hmm. for the last 8 years. And then now says, oh, but you know, you shouldn't have been here anyway.
Yeah, that's something
I'm talking about this.
Well, that's something I'm having trouble squaring. The ruling you note there that came about, you know, just after the previous year, she had said essentially you can't use the Diebold machines anymore. They replaced them with Dominions. Then she made clear in that ruling that, hey, these Dominion systems may not be much better. So,
right.
I'm having trouble, and you may still be having this trouble yourself, I get it, but I'm having trouble understanding how the very same judge back in 2019 was able to issue an order finding the old Diebold systems were so insecure that they could not be used, but 5 years later, in the same case, decides that those challenging those new systems don't have the standing to do so. That seems to be a contradiction to me. I'm not an attorney either, but it seems to be a contradiction in those two rulings in the very same case. Do you agree?
It does seem to be a major contradiction, absolutely. And if you recall, Brad, and you probably do, that you know, the 11th Circuit even said we had standing, that CGG most particularly had standing mm-hmm. because of our diversion of resources, that we've had to devote so many resources to this and divert it away from some of our other activities in other states, et cetera. And it was kind of shocking after the 11th Circuit had said, yeah, you guys got standing. You know, we're not even going to talk about it. Of course, you guys got standing, to all of a sudden find out that the lower court says, oh, no, you don't. So let's hope that we have the opportunity, and we hope that the lawyers feel like it's advisable. I don't know yet because I haven't talked with them, mm-hmm. but I'm hoping that they feel that it is advisable to take it to the 11th Circuit and see if they still have the same view that we do have standing.
And the hope there would be that the 11th Circuit says, yes, you do have standing, and basically sort of orders the lower court judge to reopen the case?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Uh-huh. Well, yes, absolutely. And to revise the opinion accordingly, because it does seem, as you've pointed out, that she tends to agree with us on the merits of the case.
Yeah. I mean, did she dispute any of your actual merit arguments or agree with those that were put forward in response to it by Brad Raffensperger, the Secretary of State's attorneys?
Not on the merits that I can remember. You mm-hmm. know, I mm-hmm. kind of have read through this fast with lots of phone calls flying around, yeah. but no, I don't think I read anything where she felt that he presented, you know, compelling facts. Our experts presented really unrebutted facts. And as you know, because you kind of followed the trial pretty closely, that they were never able to rebut Kevin Skoglund's testimony or Alex Holderman's testimony mm-hmm. or Philip Stark's testimony.
Right.
They really had nothing other than, you know, you guys are election deniers. That was their defense. You guys are bad guys.
Yeah.
You know, and you don't have standing. Y'all hadn't really been hurt. And there was really no rebuttal on the facts, on the experts' findings.
Yeah. And I kind of got to wonder if some of this has to do with, even the term election integrity, which has been co-opted by right-wingers in recent years following, you know, Trump's pretend claims that he won 2020. I'm wondering if the judge is thinking, you know what, if I side in favor of the plaintiffs who she seemed to be siding with throughout the mm-hmm. first many years of this case, you know, if that will be, if she'll be touching some sort of a third rail Trumper stop the steal kind of ruling. I know you may be back in front of her again, depending on how things go at the 11th Circuit in an appeal, if you carry one out. But do you have any sense that that might have played a role here somehow?
It's just really too hard to guess, I think. It's because those were the same circumstances we had at trial, you know, and, mm-hmm. and the trial seemed to go very, very well. Hard to know what in the environment right now seem to shift her view. I don't know. But Brett, if you read my press release of mm-hmm. yesterday, yeah. I think you're probably aware that the Georgia legislature now,
yep.
with this week, needs to act to do something, because they have got a mess on their hands. Because, you know, they have banned QR codes starting in 2026.
Yep.
And they have no budget to remove them from the ballot, to get all the new equipment they have to do. It's a $70 million fix. And they have not appropriated the budget to do it. And the session ends on Friday. And so there is a mad scramble, particularly after Judge Totenberg's ruling, to, oh my, you know, she's not going to say you have to go to hand-marked paper ballots now. Uh-huh. Now what are we going to do? And so these last few days of session until Friday are going to be really interesting to see if the Republican senators will say, oh Lord, you know, we can't leave the counties out there with no way to conduct elections legally next year, you know, because we've got some big elections. Think of the most targeted U.S. senator right now, John Ossoff. Mm-hmm. is going to be running in 2026. And the way it is planned right now is that his election will be conducted on the compromise system. And you noted that the system has been stolen mm-hmm. and software has been stolen. System's been compromised. Nothing is being done. And they are planning to run his election on that compromise system next year.
And
no
yet,
fixes.
And yet the lawmakers, the Republican state led state legislature, has basically said that voting with QR codes is unlawful in the state of Georgia. Do I understand that correctly? But they
say it is, yes. And they say you have to get rid of the barcodes by July 1st, 2026. However, Raffensperger talked them into not doing that. Leave the law on the books, but we're not going to mean it because we're, he was telling them, don't give us the $70 million. It's not a good expenditure. We agree with that. They ought to do hand-marked paper ballots instead.
Right.
His plan is just
cheaper.
His plan is just to not comply with the law. And,
well,
but yet the counties are stuck because the counties still are required to comply with the law, but yeah. they don't have the equipment or the funding to do it. Even if they had the funding, they can't go change the software on the state's equipment.
Right, to remove the QR codes. I mean, how long
right.
would it take, even if it was possible, to use the same systems but without the QR codes printed onto them, so that presumably the tabulators read the human readable text? Mind you, I find that to be completely unsatisfactory. I think that computer printed ballots are equally unverifiable after an election.
Correct.
To know whether they
Correct.
Reflect the voter intent or not, whether they use a QR code or not. But
correct.
Even without the QR codes, I mean, would they even be able to replace them if the money was allocated? Would they somehow be able to reprogram them in time for the 2026 election?
Dominion does have some software to do it, but they have estimated that even without counting the amount of time the counties would have to support this, it takes 90,000 staff hours. 90,000 staff hours to install this update, and they have to have all new printers for each of the 40,000 touchscreens. And so that's why it would cost $70 million before any county costs are considered. 90,000 hours. There are so many elections between now and the primary for next year.
Yeah.
For the general primary.
Yeah.
There are so many elections. There is only a very small window of January and February next year where that 90,000 hours could be could be devoted to updating the system. It is a ridiculous waste when they could just go to hand-marked paper ballots. But no one wants to do it because the governor absolutely has his foot on the brakes and saying, do not do it.
That's Brian Kemp, the former Secretary of State, and Brad Raffensperger, the current Secretary of State, who both support these systems. Brilliant choices, guys. Gosh, I wish someone had warned you that this mess was awaiting all of us. Wow. All right, Marilyn, do keep us in touch, as I'm sure you will, as this moves forward, as you move to the, hopefully, Court of Appeals. It'll be interesting to see what happens there. I got to say, Marilyn, before you go, whatever happens, moving forward, I know I've said it before, but it merits noting again. This nation is greatly indebted to you, to the Coalition of Good Governance, and to your critical work in this curling case, no matter what happens with it, and other matters over the years. Whatever you guys do moving forward, please know that you have my eternal gratitude, and I know many of our listeners feel that way as well. I do hope I hope they will consider supporting your work at coalitionforgoodgovernance.org so you can continue it despite the frankly, the right-wing loons who have attempted to co-op your very real election integrity work over so many years. Thank you, Marilyn.
Thank you so much.
You can find her at coalitionforgoodgovernance.org and on, I think, the Twitters at Marilyn R. Marks 1. Are you over on Blue Sky yet, Marilyn?
I am.
Same name?
And I think, yes, I think so. I have to remember. But yes, Marilyn R. Marks 1, I believe, is still the one.
Excellent. We'll see you there. Keep up the good
work.
Thanks again. Okay. Like I say, American hero.
Oh, indeed. And I just want to point out that I really think that Marilyn has a place in U.S. history for being the one person who had the presence of mind to press the record button when she got that phone call from one of the MAGA operatives who was part of that multi-pronged scheme in multiple states to try to steal the 2020 election by breaching voting systems in swing states, like in Georgia. She was the one who recorded it. She got that evidence, and that's why we know about that part of the scheme.
And somehow that idiot, that guy named Scott Hall, called her, and like you said, she had the presence of mind to hit the record button. So, among other things, we got this confession that we could play on the broadcast.
You know, I'm the guy that chartered the jet to go down to Coffee County to have them inspect all of those computers. And they scanned all the equipment, imaged all the hard drives.
They imaged the hard drives?
Yes.
How in the world did you get permission to do that?
We basically had the entire elections committee there. Okay. And they said, we give you permission. Go for it.
I believe Scott Hall has since pleaded guilty in that case.
Yes, he
has. That RICO case down in Atlanta. All right, quick break. And we're back with Desi Doyen and her latest Green News Report. Straight ahead on the broadcast, I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad. Here at the broadcast and bradblog.com, we fight for election integrity all year around, like no other media outlet in the nation. But of course, we need your help to help us remain on your public airwaves and completely independent. Please help us continue that fight over your public airwaves by stopping by bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast.
Of course, one of the ways they have been trying to reverse, to overturn the 20th century has long been in the environmental world. They really, really, really hate, you know, clean air, clean water, stuff like that. And apparently now they're ready to do everything they can to put the fossil fuel industry back on top.
Yep.
Like it was ever not on top. as the most profitable industry in the history of civilization. Anyway, That is among the topics, as usual, on today's Green News Report.
And we're going to eliminate FEMA. So we've got a lot to do.
Trump administration plans to dismantle Federal Emergency Management Agency right in the middle of hurricane season. Trump to close coal mine safety offices. Plus, Republican-controlled Congress overturns landmark fee on oil and gas drillers' methane pollution.
All of those stories and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Democrats say getting rid of FEMA would be abandoning the communities that are in need of help.
Democrats say that? Doesn't logic, reason, and common sense say that, news guy? Or is common sense just a partisan issue now, too? This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, Democrats say air should be clean so we can breathe it. What do Republicans say?
Everyone wants to know.
Uh-huh. What do you got for us today?
Well, first, spring 2025 in the United States is really delivering on weather extremes. Across the Midwest and Southeast over the weekend, another string of severe winter storms and deadly tornadoes killed at least 6 people. The latest round of extreme weather is partly why experts in disaster response are alarmed over Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem's casual comment last week in a cabinet meeting that she is working to eliminate FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency.
And we're going to eliminate FEMA. So we've got a lot to do, but it's all good, and we're working hard, and we're going to make sure that we're continuing to do exactly what you promised.
Oh, yeah, it's all good. We'll just got to get rid of FEMA. How's your day going?
The Washington Post reports that the Trump administration plans to halt FEMA's role in disaster recovery by October 1st, the height of hurricane season, pushing the burden onto states. Disaster experts say dismantling or breaking up FEMA would harm hard-hit communities still struggling to recover from past disasters and leave vulnerable areas at risk, particularly Gulf Coast states. As South Dakota governor, Noem received $36 million in FEMA money for a record flooding event last June. The emergency manager of Lincoln County, South Dakota, Harold Timmerman, warned on local news that FEMA funding has been critical to repair roads, bridges, and culverts.
Without the FEMA help, it would have been a strain on everybody involved to recover from that. You know, if the county had to fund all that replacement cost, or there's no way we have at this point in time to fund that. We're running on a limited budget now without trying to raise people taxes.
What could possibly go wrong?
But there is more than disaster aid at risk. Dismantling FEMA would also imperil the National Flood Insurance Program administered by FEMA. It was set up in the 1960s when the private flood insurance sector failed. Bloomberg News reports that the Trump administration does not appear to have a plan for the flood insurance program. Experts warn that any changes to the program or how it's run could disrupt the lives of millions of homeowners in flood-prone areas, and closing it would have far-reaching effects on the entire financial system because of mortgages tied to the program. In coal country, the Trump administration has also moved to shutter local offices of the Mine Safety and Health Administration, which enforces coal mine safety rules as part of DOJ's cuts targeting federal buildings for closure and sale.
Uh-huh.
Grist reports that coal miners and mine safety advocates are concerned that closing dozens of mine safety offices across Appalachia will reduce the capacity of an agency that has vastly improved mine safety over the past 50 years and will put miners at further risk with no one to turn to.
For years, Donald Trump said how much he loves his coal miners. He loves them so much, he's going to let them die.
The administration's cuts to coal mine safety for workers is billed as cutting costs, but the administration has proposed zero cuts to the $4 billion in annual taxpayer subsidies enjoyed by the fossil fuel industry.
Go figure.
And last week, Donald Trump signed a new new law repealing the first ever fee for methane pollution. It was passed by the Republican-controlled Congress under the Congressional Review Act, a law that allows Congress to reach back and overturn recent regulations that they don't like. Republicans repealed the federal fee on oil and gas producers who release high levels of methane, a potent climate-warming superpollutant. It had not yet gone into effect. It was a big piece of President Biden's climate policy aimed at reducing U.S. emissions that cause climate change and reducing air pollution. Congressional Republicans canceled that fee, which had been projected to bring in billions of dollars in revenue.
You're welcome, fossil fuel industry. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. Thank you very much, Desi Doyen.
Yeah, and you know, a little bit of a follow-up on that story about the Trump administration dismantling or breaking up FEMA and how that's just a really bad idea.
Yeah.
Dr. Samantha Montano, she's an emergency management expert. On Blue Sky, she says, I almost black out every time I think about how every single state needs to be hiring hundreds more people to work on emergency management right now. Some states need to hire thousands to even begin to compensate for what it would be like to manage a major disaster without FEMA. And another commenter brought up, well, what about multiple disasters in multiple states? You know, like when Hurricane Helene hit Florida and North Carolina, and there were also problems in other states at the same time. And she said, I don't even want to think about it. She said, small states do not have the capacity or the money for this. The math just does not add
up. The resources, they all have to, all states apparently, if they shut down FEMA, as they're apparently planning to do, all states will have to come up with their own emergency management system, all 50 states.
In a matter of months.
Rather than having a federal emergency management system that deploys when needed, as needed, to states.
Yeah, and on the multiple disaster scenario, she also said, I cannot emphasize enough that even FEMA doesn't have all the resources for a scenario like that. The U.S. would need international assistance, and oh yeah, look at all the countries we just pissed off.
It's all going very, very well. Again, thank you very much, Desi Doyen, our producer. Thanks to my guest today, Marilyn Marks of CoalitionForGoodGovernance.org. And thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other we have ever done since the beginning of time, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. That made possible by those of you kind enough to hit a donate button when you stop by there during these difficult times to help us stay on your public airwaves. You can also go straight to bradblog.com/donate. We really thank you and could use your support. Drop me an email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. You'll find me on the social medias at, especially Blue Sky, at The Brad Blog. Tomorrow, election results from Florida, Wisconsin, and I think Digby and Driftglass will be with us here to make sense of it all. That's it. We'll see you there. We'll see you then. We'll see you at all of the above. Until then, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.